From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Ghost of Steamboat Coulee by Arthur J. Burks. A heartless brakeman discovered me and kicked me off the train at Palisades. I didn't care greatly. As well be dropped here in Moses Coulee like a bag of spoiled meat as father up the line. When a man knows he has but a short time to live, what matters it? Had I not been endowed with a large modicum of my beloved father's stubbornness, I believe I should, long ere this, have crawled away into some hole like a mongrel cur to die. There was no chance to cheat the grim reaper. That had been settled long ago, when, without a gas mask, I had gone through a certain little town in Flanders. My lungs were just about done. Don't think I'm making a bid for sympathy. I know a sick man seldom arouses in the breast of strangers any other emotion than disgust. But I am telling this to explain my actions in those things which came later. After leaving the train at Palisades, I looked up and down the coulee. Where to go? I hadn't the slightest idea. Wenatchee lay far behind me at the edge of the mighty Columbia River. I had found this thriving little city unsympathetic and not particularly hospitable. I couldn't, therefore, retrace my steps. Besides, I never have liked to go back over lost ground. I saw the train, which had dropped me, crawl like a snake up the steep incline which led out of the coulee. I hadn't the strength to follow. I knew that I could never make the climb. So wearily I trudged out to the road and headed further into the coulee, to come some hours later to another cul-de-sac. It was another, to me, impossible incline, this time a wagon road. I have since learned that this road leads via a series of three huge terraces bridged by steep incline out of Moses Coulee. It is called the Three Devils. Don't ask me why, for it was named by the Siwash Indians. At the foot of this road, and some half mile from where it began to climb, I saw a small farmhouse from the chimney of which a spiral of blue smoke arose lazily into the air. Here were folks, country folks, upon whose hospitality I had long ago learned to rely. Grimy with the dust of the trail, damp with perspiration, red spots dancing in the air before my eyes because of the unaccustomed exertion to which I had compelled myself, I turned aside and presently knocked at the door of the farmhouse. A housewife answered my knock and nervously motioned me to enter. I was shortly pointed to a seat at the table to partake of the tasty viands brought forth. When I had finished eating, I arose from my place and was about to ask her what I might do in payment for the meal, when I was seized with a fit of coughing which left me faint and trembling. And I had barely composed myself when the woman's husband and a half-grown boy entered the house silently and looked at me. "How come a man as sick as you is out on the road afoot like this?" demanded the man. I told him my story, and that I had neither friends nor family nor abode. While I talked, they exchanged glances with one another, and when I finished, the husband looked at me steadily for a long moment. "Is there a chance for you to get well?" he asked finally. "I am afraid not." I tried to make my voice sound cheerful. "Would you like to find a place where nobody bother you, a place where you could loaf along about as you wish until your time came?" I nodded in answer to the question. The man strode to the door and pointed. "See there," he asked, "that's the road you came here on. Against that 200-foot cliff, Opposite that cliff, back of my house, is another cliff, 1,300 feet high. Matter of fact, my place is almost surrounded by cliffs. Don't need to build fences except when the coulee opens away towards Columbia River, which is some lot of miles away from here. Cliffs both sides of it all the way down. No other exit except there. As he spoke, he swung his extended forearm straight toward the cliff to the north. See what looks like a great black shadow against the face of the cliff? Right where she turns to form the curve of the coulee? Yes, I see it. Well, that ain't a shadow. That's the entrance to another and smaller coulee, which opens into this one. It is called Steamboat Coulee. And if you look sharp, you can see why. I studied that black shadow as he pointed, carefully running my eyes over the face of the cliff. Then I exclaimed suddenly. So unexpectedly did I discover the reason for the name. Right at the base of that black shadow was a great pile of stone, its color all but blending with the mother cliff unless one looked closely. And this mass of solid rock from where we stood in the doorway of the farmhouse looked like a great steamboat slowly emerging from the cleft in the giant walls. Good Lord, I exclaimed. If I didn't know better, I would swear that was a boat under steam. It's fooled a lot of folks, returned the farmer. Well, that coulee entrance is on my land, so I guess I have a right to make this proposition to you. Back inside that coulee, about 2 miles, is my old log cabin that could easy be made livable. Just a place for you, and I could send in what little food you would need. It's kind of cool at night, but in the daytime the sun makes the coulee as hot as an oven, and you could loaf all day in the heat. There are plenty of big rocks there to flop on, and who knows, maybe you'd even get well. I thank you, sir, I said as politely as I could. You're very kind. I accept your offer with great pleasure. May I know to whom I am indebted for this unusually benevolent service? The man hesitated before answering. What difference does a name make? We don't go much on last names here. That there is Reuben, my boy, and this is my wife, Hildreth. My own name is Plone. You can tell us what to call you, if you wish, but it don't make much difference if you don't care to. My name is Harold Skidmore, late of the U.S. Army. Once more, allow me to thank you. Then I shall go into my new home before it gets so dark I can't find it. That's all right. Reuben will go along and show you the place. Hilly will put up a sack of grub for you, enough to last a couple of days, and tote it in tomorrow. You'll probably be too sore from your walk to come out for a while, and we may be too busy to take any into him. The woman dropped her arms to her side and moved into the kitchen to do the bidding of Plone. Plone, what an odd name for a man. I studied him as apparently having forgotten me. He stared moodily down the haze-filled coulee. I tried to see what his eyes were seeing, but all I could tell was that he watched the road by which I had come to this place, watched it carefully and in silence, as though he expected other visitors to come around the bend which leads to the Three Devils. He did not turn back to me again, and when 10 minutes or so later Reuben touched my arm and started off in the direction of Steamboat, Plone was still staring down the road. I studied the territory over which we traveled. Though I knew absolutely nothing about farming, I would have sworn that this ground hadn't been cultivated for many years. It had been plowed once upon a time, but the plowing had been almost obliterated by scattered growth of green sagebrush, which had pushed through and begun to thrive, while in the open Reuben and I struggled through regular matted growths of wild hollyhocks, heavy with their fiery blooms. Plone's farm was nothing but a desert on the coulee floor. We were approaching Steamboat Coulee entrance, and the nearer we strode, the less I liked the bargain I had made, for the huge maw looked oddly like a great open mouth that might take one in and leave no trace. But those red spots were dancing before my eyes again, and may have helped me to imagine things. When we reached the gap, its mouth-like appearance was not so pronounced, and the rock which had looked like a steamboat did not resemble a steamboat at all. The floor of the coulee was a dry stream bed, which, when the spring freshets came, must have been a roaring torrent. Before entering, I looked back at the house of Plone and shouted in amazement, "Reuben, where is the house? I can see all of that end of the coulee, and your house is not in sight." "We come over a rise, a high one, that's all," he replied carelessly. "If we go back a piece, we can see the house. Only we ain't got time. I want to show you the cabin and get back before dark. This coulee ain't nice to get caught in after dark."
"It isn't?" I questioned. "Why not?"
But Reuben had begun the entrance to Steamboat Coulee and did not answer. I was very hesitant about following him now, for I knew that he had lied to me. We hadn't come over any rise, and I should have been able to see the farmhouse. I liked this coulee less and less as we went deeper into it. Walls rose straight on either hand, and they were so close that they seemed to be pressing over upon me. The stream bed narrowed and deepened. On its banks grew thickets of wild willow, interspersed with clumps of squawberry bushes laden with pink fruit. Behind these thickets arose the talus slope of shell rock. I studied the slopes for signs of pathways which might lead out in case a heavy rain should fill the stream bed and cut off my retreat by the usual way, but saw none. I saw instead something that filled me with a sudden feeling of dread, causing a sharp constriction of my throat. It was just a mottled mass on a large rock, but as I looked at it, the mass moved, untwisted itself, and a huge snake glided out of sight in the rocks. "Reuben," I called, "are there many snakes in this coulee?"
"Thousands," he replied, without looking back. "Rattlers, blue racers, and bullwhips, but mostly rattlers. Keep to your shanty at night and stay in the stream bed in the daytime, and they won't be any danger to you."
Well, I was terribly tired. Else I would have turned around and quitted this place. Yes, though I fell dead from exhaustion 10 minutes later. As it was, I followed Reuben, who turned aside finally and climbed out of the stream bed. I followed him and stood upon a trail which led down a gloomy aisle into a thicket of willows. Heavy shadows hung in this moody aisle, but through these I could make out the outline of a squatty log cabin. 10 minutes later, I had a fire going in the cracked stove which the house boasted, and its light was driving away the shadows in the wall. The board floor was well laid, no cracks through which venturesome rattlers might smell me out. I made sure of this before I would let Reuben get away, and that the door could be closed and bolted. "Well," said Reuben, who had stood by while I put the place rapidly to rights, "you'll be all right now, snug as a bug in a rug, if you ain't afraid of ghosts." His hand had dropped to the doorknob as he began to talk, and when he had uttered this last sinister sentence, he opened the door and slipped out before I could stop him. Those last 6 words had sent a chill through my whole body in a frenzy of fear which I could not explain. I rushed to the door and looked out, intending to call Reuben back. I swear he hadn't had time to reach that stream bed and dropped into it out of sight. But when I looked out, he was nowhere to be seen, and when I shouted his name until the echoes rang to right and left through the coulee, there was no answer. He must have fairly flown out of that thicket. I closed the door and barred it, placed a chair back under the doorknob, and sat down upon the edge of the bed, gazing into the fire. What sort of place had I wandered into? For a time, the rustling of the wind through the willows outside the log cabin was my only answer. Then a gritty, grating sound beneath the floor, slow and intermittent, told me that a huge snake, sluggish with the coolness of the evening, was crawling there, and was at that moment scraping alongside one of the timbers which supported the floor. I was safe from these, thank God. The feeling of security which now descended upon me, together with the cheery roaring of the fire in the stove,
almost lulled me to sleep as I sat. My eyes were closing wearily and my head was sinking upon my breast. A cry that the wildest imagination would never have expected to hear in this place came suddenly from somewhere in the darkness outside. It was a cry as of a little baby that awakes in the night and begs plaintively to be fed, and it came from somewhere out there in the shell rock of the talus slopes. Merciful heaven! How did it happen that a wee small child, such as I guessed this to be, had wandered out into the darkness of the coulee? Whence had it come? Were there other inhabitants in Steamboat? But Plone had not mentioned any. Then how explain that eerie cry outside? A possible explanation, inspired by frayed nerves, came to me and froze the marrow of my bones before I could reason myself out of it. If ye ain't afraid of ghosts? What had Reuben of the unknown surname meant by this remark? And by what means had he so swiftly disappeared after he had quitted my new home? Just as I asked myself the question, that wailing cry came again, from about the same place, as near as I could judge, on the talus slope in rear of my cabin, unmistakably the cry of a lost baby, demanding by every means of expression in its power the attention of its mother. Out there alone and frightened in the darkness, in the heart of Steamboat Coulee, which Reuben had told me was infested by great numbers of snakes, at least one kind of which was venomous enough to slay. Dread tugged at my throat. My tongue became dry in my mouth, cleaving to the palate. I knew before I opened the door that the coulee was now as dark as Erebus, and that moving about would be like groping in some gigantic pocket. But there was a feeble child out there on the talus slope, lost in the darkness, wailing for its mother, and I prided myself upon being at least a semblance of a man. Mentally girding myself, I strode to the door and flung it open. A miasmic mist came in immediately, cold as the breath from a sunless marsh, chilling me anew. Instinctively I closed the door as though to shut out some loathsome presence, I know not what. The heat of the fire absorbed the wisp of vapor that had entered. I leaned against the door, panting with a nameless terror, when from the talus slope outside, plain through the darkness, came again that eerie wailing. Gulping swiftly, swallowing my terrible fear, I closed my eyes and flung the door wide open. Nor did I close it until I stood outside and opened my eyes against an opaque blanket of darkness. When Plone had told me the coulee was cold after nightfall, he had not exaggerated. It was as cold as the inside of a tomb. The crying of the babe came again, from directly behind my cabin. The cliff bulked large there, while above its rim high up I made out the soft twinkling of a pale star or two. Before my courage should fail me and send me back into the cheery cabin, thrice cheery now that I was outside it, I ran swiftly around the cabin, nor stopped until I had begun to clamber up the talus slope, guided by my memory of whence that wailing cry had come. The shell rock shifted beneath me, and I could hear the shale go clattering down among the brush about the bases of the willows below. I kept on climbing. Once I almost fell when I stepped upon something round, which writhed beneath my foot, causing me to jump straight into the air with a half-suppressed cry of fear. I was glad now that the coulee was cold after nightfall, else the snake, were it by chance a rattler, could have struck me a death blow. The cold, however, made the vile creature sluggish. When I thought I had climbed far enough, I bent over and tried to pierce the heavy gloom, searching the talus intently for a glimpse of white. White which should discover to me the clothing of the baby which I sought. Failing in this, I remained quiet, waiting for the cry to come again. I waited amid a silence that could almost be felt, a silence lasting so long that I began to dread a repetition of that cry. What if there was no baby? Flesh and blood, that is. Reuben had spoken of ghosts. Utter nonsense. No grown man believes in ghosts. And if I didn't find the child before long, the little tot might die of cold. Where had the child gone? Why the eerie silence? Why didn't the child cry again? It was almost as though it had found that which it sought, there in the darkness. That cry had spoken eloquently of a desire for sustenance. If the child did not cry, what was I to believe? Who or what was suckling the baby out on the cold talus slope? I became as a man turned to stone when the eerie cry came again. It was not a baby's whimper, starting low and increasing in volume. It was a full-grown wail as it issued from the unseen mouth, and it came from at least 100 feet higher up on the talus. I, a grown man, had stumbled heavily in the scramble to reach this height, yet a baby so small that it wailed for its milk had crept 100 feet further up the slope. It was beyond all reason, weird beyond the wildest imagination, but undoubtedly the wailing of a babe. I did not believe in ghosts. I studied the spot whence the wail issued, but could see no blotch of white, only 2 lambent dots, set close together, glowing like rusting fireflies among the shale. I saw them for but a second only. Undoubtedly mating fireflies, and they had flown. I began to climb once more, moving steadily toward the spot where I had heard the cry. I stopped again when the shell rock above me began to flow downward as though something or somebody had started it moving. What in God's name was up there at the base of the cliff? Slowly, my heart in my mouth, I climbed on. There was a rush, as of an unseen body. Along the face of the talus, I could hear the contact of light feet on the shale, but the points of contact were unbelievably far apart. No baby in the world could have stepped so far or jumped. Of course, the cry might have come from a half-witted grown person, but I did not believe it. The cry again sharp and clear, but at least 200 yards up the coulee from where I stood, and on about a level with me. Should I follow or not? Did some nocturnal animal carry the babe in its teeth? It might be. I had heard of such things, and had read the myth of Romulus and Remus. Distorted fantasies? Perhaps, but show me a man who can think coolly while standing on the talus slopes of the steamboat after dark, and I will show you a man without nerves and without a soul. Once more I took up the chase. I had almost reached the spot whence the cry had come last, when I saw again those twin balls of lambent flame. They seemed to blink at me, off and on, off and on. I bent over to pick up a bit of shale to hurl at the dots, when almost in my ears that cry came once more. But this time the cry ended in a splitting snarl as of a tomcat when possession of food is disputed. With all my might, I hurled the bit of shale I had lifted straight at those dots of flame. At the same time, I gave utterance to a yell that set the echoes rolling the length and breadth of the coulee. The echoes had not died away when the coulee was filled until it rang with that eerie wailing, as though 100 babies cried for mothers who did not come. Then, great God, I knew. Bobcats. The coulee was alive with them. I was alone on the talus, 200 yards from the safe haven of my cabin, and though I knew that one alone would not attack a man in the open, I had never heard whether they hunted in groups. For all I knew, they might. At imminent risk of breaking my neck, I hurled myself down the slope and into the thicket of willows at the base. Through these and into the dry stream bed I blundered, still running. I kept this mad pace until I had reached the approximate point where the trail led to my cabin, climbed the bank of the dry stream, and sought for the aisle through the willows. Though I searched carefully for 100 yards on each hand, I could not find the path, and I feared to enter the willow thicket and beat about. The ominous wailing had stopped suddenly as though at a signal, and I believed that the bobcats had taken to the trees at the foot of the talus. I studied the dark shadows for dots of flame in pairs, but could see none. I knew from reading about them that bobcats have been known to drop on solitary travelers from the limbs of trees. Their sudden silence was weighted with ponderous menace. I was afraid. Afraid. Scared as I had never been in my life before. And I had gone through a certain town in Flanders without a gas mask. Why the sudden eerie silence? I would have welcomed that vast chorus of wailing had it begun again. But it did not. When I crept back to the bank of the stream bed, a pale moon had come up, partly dispelling the shadows in Steamboat Coulee. The sand in the stream bed glistened frostily in the moonlight, making me think of the blinking eyes of a multitude of toads. Where in Steamboat was the cabin with its cheery fire? I had closed the door to keep my courage from failing me, and now there was no light to guide me. It is hell to be alone in such a place, miles from the nearest other human being. I sat down on the high bank, half sideways so that I could watch the shadows among the willows, and tried mentally to retrace my steps, hoping that I could reason out the exact location of the cabin in the thicket. Sitting as I was, I could see for 100 yards or so down the stream bed. I studied an almost straight course for a moment or two, for no reason that I can assign. I saw a black shadow dart across the open space, swift as a breath of wind, and disappear in the thicket on the opposite side. It was larger than a cat, smaller than the average dog. A bobcat had changed his base hurriedly and in silence. Silence. That was the thing that was now weighing upon me, more even than the thought of my failure to locate the little cabin. Why had the cats stopped their wailing so suddenly, as though they waited for something? This thought deepened the feeling of dread that was upon me. If the cats were waiting, for what were they waiting? Then I breathed a sigh of relief. For coming around a bend in the stream bed, there strode swiftly toward me the figure of a man. He was a big man, who looked straight before him. He walked as a countryman walks when he hurries home to a late supper. Then there were other people in this coulee after all. But what puzzled me about this newcomer was his style of dress. He was garbed after the manner of the first pioneers who had come into this country from the east. From his high-top boots, into which his trousers were tucked loosely, to his broad-brimmed hat, he was dressed after the manner of those people who had vanished from this country more than a decade before my time. An old prospector, evidently, who had clung to the habiliments of his younger days. But he did not walk like an old man. Rather, he strode, straight-limbed and erect, like a man in his early 30s. There was a homely touch about him, though picturesque as he was, for he smoked a corncob pipe, from the bowl of which a spiral of blue smoke eddied forth into the chill night air. I knew from this that, did I call to him, his greeting in return would be bluffly friendly. I waited for him to come closer, hoping that he would notice me first. As he approached, I noticed with a start that two huge revolvers, the holsters tied back, swung low upon his hips. People nowadays did not carry firearms openly. In an instant, I had decided to let this stranger pass, even though I spent the remainder of the night on the bank of the dry stream. Sight of those savage weapons had filled me with a new and different kind of dread. Then I started as another figure, also of a man, came around the selfsame bend of the watercourse, for there was something oddly familiar about that other figure. He moved swiftly, his body almost bent double, as he hurried forward. As he came around the bend and saw the first man who had come into my range of vision, he bent lower still. As he did so, the moonlight glowed dully on something that he carried in the crook of his arm. I knew instantly that what he carried was a rifle. Once more that chill along my spine, for there was no mistaking his attitude. He was stalking the first man, furtively, and there was murder in his heart. It did not take his next action to prove this to me. I knew it. Even as the second man knelt swiftly in the sand of the watercourse and flung the rifle to his shoulder, its muzzle pointing at the man approaching me. I cried out with all the power of my shattered lungs, but the man ahead all unconscious of the impending death at his heels, paid me absolutely no attention. He was no more than 20 yards from me when I shouted, yet he did not turn his head. For all the attention he paid me, I might as well have remained silent. It was as though he were stone deaf. I shouted again, waving my arms wildly. Perhaps he could not see me because of the shadows at my back. Still he did not see me. I whirled to the kneeling man, just as a sheet of yellow flame leaped from the muzzle of his rifle. The first man was right in front of me when the bullet struck him. He stopped, dead in his tracks. I guess that the bullet had struck him at the base of the skull. Even so, he whirled swiftly, and both his guns were out, but he could not raise them to fire. He slumped forward limply and sprawled in the sand. I had not heard the report of the rifle, for simultaneously with that spurt of flame, the bobcats had begun their wailing once more, drowning out the sound. With a great cry, whose echoes could be heard in the coulee even though the wailing of the bobcats, I sprang to my feet and ran, staggering down the watercourse in the direction of what I thought was Steamboat's entrance. Long before I had reached it, my poor body failed me, and I fell to the sandy floor, coughing my lungs away, while scarlet stains wetted the sand near my mouth. When I awoke in the sand, the sun was shining. Some sixth sense told me to remain motionless, warning me that all was not well. Without moving my head, I rolled my eyes until I could see ahead in the direction I had fallen. In falling, my right hand had been flung out full length, fingers extended. Imagine my fear and horror when I saw, coiled up within 6 inches of my hand, a huge rattlesnake. His head was poised above the coil, while just behind it, against the other arc of the vicious circle, the tip of the creature's tail, adorned with an inch or more of rattles, hummed its fearful warning. With all my power, I sprang back and upward. At that same time, the bullet head, unbelievably swift, flashed towards my hand and, thank God, safely beneath it. Stretched helplessly now to its full length, the creature's mouth, with its forked tongue, had stopped within a scant 2 inches of where my face had been. Before the rattler could return and coil again, I had stepped up upon the bullet head, grinding it deep into the sand, and when the tail whipped frantically against my leg, I seized it and hurled the reptile with all my might out of the stream bed into the shell rock. Even as I did it, I wondered where I had found the courage and what had kept me from moving while unconscious. Had I moved, I might never have awakened. I climbed the bank of the dry stream to look for the entrance to my log cabin, which I believed lay ahead of me, but kept well away from the thickets for fear of snakes. With the sun high in the heavens, turning the coulee into a furnace, the snakes came out by hundreds to bask upon the shale. As I passed, they coiled and warned me away with myriad warnings. I did not trespass upon their holdings. After I had plodded along for fully an hour, I knew that I must be quite close to the rock which gave Steamboat its name. But still, I had not found the pathway leading to the log cabin. Evidently, I had already passed it. Even as I had this thought, I came upon a path leading into the shadows of the willow thicket. A path that seemed familiar, even though from the stream bed I could not see the cabin. With a sigh and much surprise that I had, last night, traveled so far in my hysterical terror, I turned into this path and increased my pace. I came shortly to pause, chilled even though the sun was shining, for at the end of the mossy trail there was no cabin, but a cleared plot of ground adorned with aged mounds and rough-hewn crosses. Rocks were scattered profusely over the mounds, and I guess had been placed to foil the creatures which otherwise would have despoiled the bodies resting there. There was a great overhang of the cliff wall, bulging out over the little graveyard, and from the overhang came a steady drip of moisture. Slimy water lay motionless in a pool in the center of the plot. Mossy green were the stones. Mud puppies scurried into the deeps as I stopped and stared, turning the water to a pool of slime. How uneasy I felt in this place. Why had such a remote location been chosen as a cemetery, hidden away here from the brightness of God's sunshine? nothing but shadow-filled silence, except for the dripping of the water from the overhang. I hurried back to the stream bed and continued on my way. Another hour passed, during which my body racked with the continual coughing I suffered the torments of the damned. Those red dots were dancing before my eyes again, and nothing looked natural to me. The sunning snakes in the shale seemed to waver grotesquely, twisting, writhing, coiling. Here on the cliff was a row of ponderous palisades, but they seemed to be ever buckling and bending, as though shaken by an earthquake. Then far ahead I saw the rock of the entrance. With a sob of joy I began to run, only to stop when I reached the pile, with a cry of hopelessness and despair, for the rock, unscalable even to one who possessed the strength to climb, now filled the coulee from lip to lip, while on my side of the pile there nestled a little lake, clear and pellucid, into which I could look straight down for what I guess must have been all of 20 feet. Some great shifting of the walls during the night had blocked the entrance, entombing me in Steamboat Coulee with all its nameless horrors. There was no one to see me, so I flung myself down at the edge of the pool and wept weakly, bemoaning my terrible fate. After a time I regained control of my frayed nerves, arose to my knees, and bathed my throbbing temples. Sometime, somehow, I reasoned, Plone would find a way to reach me. There was nothing to do now but return and search again for my cabin. Plone had said that Hildreth would bring supplies to me, and I felt that they would know how to get in by some other way. They had lived in the coulee and should know their way about. Wearily, I began the return march. It never occurred to me to note that the sun went ahead of me on its journey into the west. I can only blame my physical condition for not noting this. Had I done so, I would have realized at once that I had gone in the wrong direction, and that straight ahead of me lay freedom. I had gone to the head of the coulee, straight in from Steamboat Rock, and when I found the coulee blocked at the end, had thought the entrance closed against me. But I did not note the sun. I strode wearily on and found the cabin with ridiculous ease. Inside, awaiting my coming, sat Hildreth, the wife of Plone. She said nothing when I opened the door, just sat on the only chair in the house and looked at me. I spoke to her, thanking her for the sack of provisions, which I saw on the rickety shelf on the wall beyond the door. Still, she said nothing, just stared at me, unblinking. I asked her about leaving this place, and she shook her head, as though she did not catch my meaning. "For God's sake, Hildreth," I cried, "can't you speak?" For it had come to me that I had never heard her speak. When I had first entered the farmhouse, she had placed a meal for me, and had bidden me eat of it, but I remembered now that she had done so by gestures with her hands. In answer now to my question, she opened her mouth and pointed into it with her forefinger. Hildreth, the wife of Plone, had no tongue. Did you ever hear a tongueless person try to speak? It is terrible. For after this all-meaning gesture there came a raucous croak from the mouth of Hildreth, wordless, gurgling, altogether meaningless. I understood no word, but the eyes of the woman, strangely glowing now, were eloquent. She pointed toward the door, trying to warn me of something, and stamped her foot impatiently when I did not understand. I saw her foot move as she stamped it, but failed to notice at the time that the contact of her foot with the floorboards made no noise. Later I remembered it. When I shook my head, she arose from her chair and strode to the door, flinging it wide. Then she pointed up the coulee in the direction I had entered originally. Again that raucous croak, still meaningless. Once more I shook my head. Was there something by the entrance that menaced me? I was filled with dread of the unknown, wished with all my soul that I could understand what this woman was trying to say to me. I stepped back to search about the place for papers so that with the aid of a pencil which I possessed, she might write that she had to tell me. I found it and turned back to the woman, who had watched me gravely while I searched. Noting the paper, she shook her head, telling me mutely that she could not write. Then Plone, his face as dark as a thundercloud, stood in the doorway. To me, he paid no attention. His eyes, glowing below heavy brows, burned as he stared at the woman. In her eyes, I could read fright unutterable. She gave one frightened croak and turned to flee. But she could not go far, for she fled toward the bare wall opposite the open door. Plone leaped after her, and when I jumped between them, he flung me to the floor where I bumped my head and lay stunned for a moment. In that horrifying instant, I realized why the murderer looked familiar last night. It was Plone. I half arose and whirled around to see what aid I could offer Hildreth, but they had vanished just like Reuben had the night before. Trembling in every fiber of my being, I strode to the back wall and ran my hand over the rough logs. They were as solid almost as the day of the cabin had been built. To me this was a great relief. I was beginning to fear that I had stumbled into a land of wraiths and shadows, or was hallucinating, and I should not have been surprised if the logs had also proved to be things of shadow substance, letting me through to stand amazed upon the shell rock behind the cabin. But there was one place in the coulee of shadows that was real. I went to the door, locked and barred it. Then I returned and lighted the stove to disperse the unnatural chill that hovered in the room. After this, I searched out my food and wolfed some of it ravenously. Another thought came to me. If Reuben, Plone, and Hildreth were nothing but fantasies, where had I procured this food, which was real enough and well cooked? Somewhere in my adventures since being kicked off the train at Palisades, there must be a great gap I had tried to fill in. What had happened, really, in that blank space? Having eaten, I stepped to the door and looked out. If I again went forth into the stream bed and any attempt to get out of the coulee, I should never reach it before dark. What would it mean to my tired reason to be caught in the open in the midst of this coulee for another terrible night? I could not do it. Again, I secured the door. Nothing real could get in to bother me. And even now, I reasoned myself out of positive belief in ghosts. The hallucinations which had so terrified me had undoubtedly been born of my sickness. Convinced of this, I at least lay down on the rough cot and went to sleep. When I awoke suddenly in the night, the fire had burned very low and a heavy chill possessed the cabin. I had a feeling that I was not the only occupant of my abode, but striving to pierce the gloom in the cabin's corners, I could see nothing. In the furthest corner, I saw the pale, ghostly lineaments of a woman, just the face, shimmering there in the gloom, oddly, but neither body nor substance. The face of Hildreth, wife of Plone. Then her hands, no arms visible, came up before her face and began to gesture. Her mouth opened, and I imagine I again heard that raucous croak of the tongueless. Again her eyes were eloquent, mutely giving a warning which I could not understand. Fear seizing me in its terrible grip, I leaped from my bed and threw wood on the fire, hoping to dispel its silent shadow. When the light flared up, the head shimmered swiftly and began to fade away. But not before I saw a pair of hands come forth from nowhere and fasten themselves below that head, about where the neck should have been. Hands that were gnarled and calloused from toil on an unproductive farm. The war-torn hands of the killer Plone. Then the weird picture vanished and I was alone with my fantasies. I had scarcely returned to my seat on the bed, sitting well back against the wall so that my back was against something solid, when the wailing of lost babies broke out again on the talus slopes outside. I had expected this to happen after nightfall, but the reality left me weak and shivering, even though I knew that the animals that uttered the mournful wails were flesh and blood. The wailing of bobcats, no matter how often it is heard, always brings a chill that is hard to reason away. Nature certainly prepared weird natural protections for some of her creatures. Then the wailing stopped suddenly, short off, and the silence was more nerve-devastating than the eerie wailing. Nothing for many minutes, then the rattle of sliding talus as the shale glided into the underbrush. This stopped, and a terrible silence pressed down upon me. Then my cabin shook with the force of the wind that suddenly swooped through the coulee. It rattled through the eaves, shook the door on its hinges, while the pitter-patter on the roof told me of showers of sand which the wind had scooped up from the bed of the dry stream. The wind was terrific, I thought, but ever it increased in power and violence. The patter on the roof and the rattle in the eaves began to take on a new significance, for the patter sounded like the scamper of baby feet above my head, while the wailing about the eaves sounded like the screaming of people who are tongueless. The door bellied inward against the chair back, as though many hands were pressed against it from outside, seeking entrance. Yet I knew there was no one outside. Then, faint and feeble, through the roaring of the wind, I caught that eerie cry in the night. It was the despairing voice of a woman, and she was calling aloud, hopelessly, for help. I shivered and tried not to hear, but the cry came again, further now, as though the woman were being dragged away from me. God's name, what woman could be abroad in such a night? The cry again. No man, fear the shadows as he might, could ignore that pitiful plea and call himself a man again. I gritted my teeth and ran to the door, flinging it open. A veritable sea of flying sand swept past me, but through the increased roar came plainly that cry for help. I left the door open this time, so that the light would stream out and guide my return. On the bank of the dry stream I stopped, and before and below me I saw Hildreth, wife of Plone, fighting for very life with her brutal husband. She was groveling on her knees at his feet. His hands were about her throat. As she begged for mercy, I could understand her words. She had a tongue after all. Then Plone, holding Hildreth with his left hand, raised his right, and crooking it like a fearful talon, poised it above the face of Hildreth. He did a ghastly, unbelievable thing. I cannot tell it. But when his hand came away, her words were meaningless gurgling, the raucous croaking of a person who had no tongue. Frenzied with horror at what Plone had done, I leaped into the dry stream and ran forward to bring up short in the middle of the sandy open space, staring aghast. For I was all alone. No Hildreth, the tongueless, no Plone with the calloused hands. Once more hallucination had betrayed me. Screaming in fear, I sprang out of the stream bed and rushed toward the cabin, only to dart off the trail as I saw another man walk out of the cabin's light. He was dressed very much as had been the man whom I had seen fall before the murderous rifle of Plone last night. But he was older, stooped slightly under the weight of years. I heard him sigh softly, as a man sighs whose stomach is comfortably filled with food. He walked toward a stream bed, following the path through the thicket. He had passed me when a malevolently leering figure followed him from the cabin. And that figure was Reuben, the feral son of Plone. Reuben, as his father had stalked that other unfortunate, stalked the aged man who preceded him. The latter passed a clump of serviceberry bushes and paused on the lip of the dry stream. He had scarcely halted when out of the clump of serviceberry stepped Plone himself, moving stealthily like a cat that stalks a helpless, unsuspecting bird. The older man half turned as though he heard some slight sound, when Plone, with a silent fury of the bobcat making a kill, leaped boldly upon the back and bore him to the ground, where the two of them, fighting and clawing, rolled into the sand below. Reuben began to run when his father closed with the stranger, and I was right at his heels when he leaped over the edge to stop beside the silent combatants. Then he bent to assist his father. The end was speedy. For what chance has an aged man taken by surprise against two determined killers? They slew him there in the sand, while I, my limbs inert because of my fright, looked on, horror holding me mute when I would have screamed aloud. Their bloody purpose accomplished, Reuben and Plone methodically began to turn the pockets of the dead man inside out. The contents of these they divided between themselves. This finished in silence, the murderers, taking each an arm of the dead man, began to drag the body up the sandy stretch toward the end of the coulee, the closed end. Still I stood, as one transfixed. Then I became conscious of a low, heartbreaking sobbing at my side. Turning, I saw the figure of Hildreth standing there, tragedy easily readable in her eyes, wringing her hands as her eyes followed the figure of her husband and her son. Then she extended her hands in a pleading gesture, calling the two who dragged the body. She began to follow them along the stream bed, dodging from thicket to thicket on the bank as though she screened her movements from Plone and Reuben. I watched her until her wraith-like form blended with the shadows in the thickets and disappeared from view. As I watched her go and saw the figure of Plone and Reuben passing around a sharp bend in the dry stream, there came back to my memory a mental picture of a graveyard located in perpetual shadow, adorned with rotting crosses upon which no names were written, slimy stones at the edge of a muddy pool populated by serpentine mud puppies. Turning then, I hurried back to the cabin, whose door remained open, to pause aghast at the threshold, staring into the interior. At a table in the center of the room, a table loaded with things to eat, fresh and steaming from the stove, sat another stranger, this time a man dressed after the manner of city folk. His clothing bespoke wealth and refinement, while his manner of eating told that he was accustomed to choicer foods than that of which necessity now compelled him to partake. Daintily he picked over the viands, sorting judiciously, while near the stove stood Hildreth, her eyes wide with fright and wordless entreaty. Reuben stood in a darkened corner, and his eyes never left the figure of the stranger at the table. As he stared at this one, I saw his tongue come forth from his mouth and describe a circle, moistening his lips anticipatorily like a cat that watches a saucer of cream. Plone, too, was silently watching, standing just inside the door with his back toward me. As I watched him, he moved slightly, edging toward the table. Then Plone was upon the stranger, a carving knife snatched from the table in his hand. But why continue? I had seen this same scene slightly varied but a few minutes before in the sand of the dry stream. Crouching there in the darkness, I guessed what the Wraith of Hildreth had tried to tell me. Going back in my memory, I watched her lips move again, and as they moved, I read the words she would have uttered. As plain as though she had spoken, I now understood the warning. As you value the life God has given you, do not stay in this cabin tonight. The cabin was a trap. The ghosts of Reuben and Plone, for surely they must be ghosts, knew where it was, and could shimmer through its walls to slay me at their will. By chance, I had escaped being murdered by going outside both nights. But until I escaped the coulee, I could be found and killed. For hours, I trembled in the shadows, afraid to move, while Reuben and Plone carried forward their ghastly work. Many times during those hours did I see them make their kill. Ever it was Plone who commanded. Ever it was Reuben who stood at his father's side to assist. Ever it was Hildreth who raised her hand or her voice in protest. Then suddenly, she was back in the cabin with Reuben and Plone. She took the latter something, gesturing vehemently as she spoke. These gestures were simple, easy to understand, for she pointed back down the coulee in the direction of Steamboat Rock. Somehow I knew that what she tried to tell me was that she had gone forth and told the authorities what he and Reuben had done. Plone's face became black with wrath. Reuben turned to the pasty gray of fear, which is unbounded. Both sprang to the door and stared down the coulee. Then Plone leaped back to Hildreth, striking her in the face with his fist. She fell to the floor, groveling on her knees at his feet. He dragged her forth into the trail, along it to the stream bed, and as I crept toward the edge, repeated that terrible scene I had witnessed once before. Reuben advanced to the lip of the dry stream as Plone fought with Reuben's mother. He paid them no heed, however, but shaded his eyes with his hand as he gazed into the west in the direction of Steamboat Rock. Then he gestured excitedly to Plone, pointing down the coulee. Plone was all activity at once. With Reuben at his heels and Hildreth stumbling further in the rear, they rushed to the cabin and began to throw rough packs together, one each for Reuben and Plone. but in the midst of their activities they paused and stared at the doorway where I stood transfixed. Then slowly, though no one stood there except myself, they raised their hands above their heads, while Hildreth crouched in a corner, wild-eyed, whimpering. Plone and Reuben suddenly lurched toward me, haltingly as though propelled by invisible hands. Their hands were at their sides now, as though bound, there securely by ropes. Outside they came, walking oddly with their hands still at their sides. They stopped beneath a tree, which had one bare limb, high up from the ground, a strong limb, white as a ghost in the moonlight. Reuben and Plone looked upward at this limb, and both their faces were gray. Hildreth came out and stood nearby, also looking up, wringing her hands, grief marring her face that might once have been beautiful. Reuben and Plone looked at each other and nodded. Then they looked mutely at Hildreth, as though asking her forgiveness. After this, they turned and nodded toward no one that I could see, as though they gestured to unseen hagmen. I cried aloud, even though I had foreseen what was to come, as both Plone and Reuben sprang straight into the air to an unbelievable height, to pause midway to that bare limb, their necks twisted at odd angles, their bodies writhing grotesquely. I watched until the writhing stopped, until the bodies merely swayed as though played upon by vagrant breezes sweeping in from the sandy dry stream. Then for the last time I heard the piercing, wordless shriek of a tongueless woman. I swerved to look for Hildreth and saw a misty, wraith-like shadow disappear among the willows, flashing swiftly out of sight up the coulee. Hildreth had gone, and I was alone, swaying weakly, nauseated, staring crazily up to two bodies which oscillated to and fro as though played upon by vagrant breezes. Then the bodies faded slowly away as my knees began to buckle under me. I sank to the ground before the cabin and darkness descended once more. When I regained consciousness, I opened my eyes, expecting to see those swaying bodies in the air above me. There were no bodies. Then I noted that my wrists were closed together, held in place by manacles of shining steel. From the cabin behind me came the sound of voices, voices of men who talked as they ate, noisily. Behind the cabin I could hear the impatient stamping of horses. I lay there dully trying to understand it all. Then two men came out of the cabin toward me. One of them chewed busily upon a bit of wood in lieu of a toothpick. Upon the mottled vest of this one glistened a star, emblem of the sheriff. The second man I knew to be his deputy. "He's awake, I see, Al," said the man as he looked at me. "So I see," said the man addressed as Al. Then the sheriff bent over me. "Ready to talk, young man?" he demanded. It must have mystified this one greatly when I leaped suddenly to my feet and ran my hands over him swiftly. How could they guess what it meant to me to learn that these two were flesh and blood? "Thank God," I cried. Then I began to tremble so violently that the man called Al perforce supported me with a burly arm about my shoulders. As he did so, his eyes met those of the sheriff, and a meaningful glance passed between them. The sheriff passed around the cabin, returning almost at once with three horses, saddled and bridled, for the trail. The third horse was for me. Weakly, aided by Al, I mounted. Then we clambered down into the dry stream and started toward Steamboat Rock. I found my voice. "For what am I wanted, Sheriff?" I asked. "For burglarious entry, son," he replied, not unkindly. "You went into a house in Palisades, while the owner and his wife were working the fields, and stole every bit of food you could lay your hands on. There's no use denying it, for we found the sack you brought it away in, right in that there cabin." "But Hildreth, the wife of Plone, gave me that food," I cried. "I didn't steal it." "Hildreth? Plone?" The sheriff fairly shouted the two names. Then he turned and stared at his deputy. Again that meaningful exchange of glances. The sheriff regained control of himself. "This Hildreth and Plone," he began, hesitatingly, strangely. "Did they have a son? A half-grown boy?"
"Yes, yes," I cried eagerly. "The boy's name was Reuben. He led me into Steamboat Coulee."
Then I told them my story from beginning to end, sparing none of the unbelievable details. When I had finished, the two of them turned in their saddles and looked back into the coulee, toward the now invisible log cabin we had left behind. The deputy shook his head, muttering, while the sheriff removed his hat and scratched his poll. He spat judiciously into the sand of the dry stream before he spoke. "Son," he said finally, "if I didn't know you was a stranger here, I would swear that you was crazy as a loon. There ain't a darn thing real about what you saw or heard, except the rattlesnakes and the bobcats." I interrupted him eagerly. "But what about Plone, Hildreth, and Reuben?" "Plone and Reuben," he replied, "were hanged 15 years ago, right beside that cabin where we found you. Hildreth went crazy and ran away into the coulee. She was never seen again." I waited breathless for the sheriff to continue. "Plone and Reuben," he went on, "were the real boogeymen of this coulee in the early days. They lived in that log cabin. Reuben used to lure strangers in there, where the two of them murdered the wanderers and robbed their dead bodies, burying them afterwards in a gruesome graveyard further inside Steamboat Coulee. Hildreth, so the story goes, tried to prevent these murders, but was unable to do so. Finally, she reported to the Pioneer authorities, and Plone cut her tongue out as punishment for the betrayal. God knows how many unsuspecting travelers the two made away with before they were found out and strung up without trial."
"But how about Plone's farm in Moses Coulee, outside Steamboat, and the farmhouse where I met the family?"
"It's mine," replied the sheriff. "There's never been a house on it, to my knowledge. I foreclosed on it for the taxes, and the blasted land is so poor that even the rattlesnakes starve while they're crawling across it."
"But I saw it as plainly as I see you."
"But you're a sick man, ain't you? You never went near the place where you say the house was. We followed your footprints, and they left the main road at the foot of the Three Devils, from which they went straight as a die to the mouth of Steamboat Coulee. That was easy to follow, and if I hadn't had another case, I'd have picked you up before you ever could have reached the cabin." Word to God that he had. It would have saved me many a weird and terrifying nightmare in the nights which have followed. There the matter ended, seemingly. The sheriff, not a bad fellow at all, put me in the way of work, which, keeping me much in the open beneath God's purifying sunshine, is slowly but surely mending my ravished lungs. After a while, there will come a day when I shall no longer be a sick man. But ever so often I raise my eyes from my work, allowing them to wander against my will in the direction of that shadow against the walls of Moses Coulee, that shadow out of which seems slowly to float the stony likeness of a steamboat under reduced power. And I wonder.